Welcome to or welcome back to Colonial Outcast, your friendly neighborhood anti-imperialist podcast. My name is Greg Stoker, and I will be hosting solo today because we're consulting with the United Kingdom today, and scheduling issues were a thing. Here we open on action, so get ready to learn about Julian Assange and his ongoing extradition trial to the United States. So diving right in, Julian Assange is an Australian editor, publisher, and activist who founded WikiLeaks in 2006. He came to wide international attention in 2010 when WikiLeaks published a series of leaks from U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning. Footage of a U.S. airstrike in Baghdad, which we'll play during this episode, U.S. military logs from Afghanistan and the Iraq wars, and U.S. diplomatic cables that were all classified secret or top secret. Essentially, the U.S. is trying to extradite him under the Espionage Act. This comes after a decade-long witch hunt, and as of today, March 26, London's High Court has granted him reprieve and has given the U.S. government 3 weeks to provide, quote, satisfactory assurances, unquote. Assange will receive a fair trial, have his First Amendment free speech rights protected, and will not face the death penalty if he is extradited from the UK to the United States. Assange will be allowed a full appeal hearing against his extradition in May if those assurances aren't provided in time, the court ruled. So you could easily argue that this entire escapade poses a threat to every journalist around the world, which we'll get into. The video I mentioned a moment ago shows ISR footage from an attack helicopter of two American pilots gunning down 12 to 18 civilian men in Iraq. Instead of trying the pilots for war crimes, the U.S. Attorney General decided to go after Assange for violating the U.S. Espionage Act of 1917, which is a relic of World War I that states that the government is allowed to imprison anyone who publishes, quote, any disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the form of government of the United States, unquote. What is notable about this is that Assange is not a U.S. citizen, nor has he ever lived in the United States. Moreover, nothing WikiLeaks has published has been shown to be false, so the information was truthful, not scurrilous. And finally, WikiLeaks didn't publish this information alone. They partnered with publications such as the New York Times and The Guardian, yet those outlets haven't received the same treatments as WikiLeaks. This is why the charges are widely seen as fraudulent and inhumane, with many human rights organizations and UN experts urging the U.S. Justice Department to drop the charges. This potential extradition would send a chilling message to investigative journalists around the globe, as Assange did what investigative journalists are supposed to do, dig up sources, documents, information secrets, and reveal them to the public interest. It would also set a mind-boggling precedent where U.S. censorship laws would apply to other countries. This would effectively make any journalism that criticizes U.S. practices around the world a punishable offense, in theory, and maybe in practice if this goes through. So to help us get into the weeds of this mess, we are joined again by Alina Xenofontos, an international law and globalization specialist. She has worked as a researcher in international and EU policy with special focus on financial and corporate crime. She has worked with organizations such as SOMO, the Center for Research on Multinational Corporations, based in the Netherlands, among other similar institutions. All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me again.
All right. So now I know some members of the audience are unfamiliar with Julian Assange. So I'm going to play a 3-minute clip that you sent me from an interview where he implicates a connection between the Clinton Foundation and the genesis of the Islamic State in Syria and the Levant. And then we're going to just dive right in and take this thing point by point. Trigger warning, these guys talk slowly. So there's the interviewer and then Julian Assange talking about the Clinton Foundation and Saudi and other Gulf interests.
Foreign policy of the United States. That's where, for me anyway, where the emails are most revealing, where they show the direct connection between Hillary Clinton and the foundation of jihadism, of ISIL, in the Middle East. Can you talk something about that? How the emails demonstrate this connection between those who are meant to be fighting the jihadists, ISIL, are actually those who have helped create it?
There's a early 2014 email from Hillary Clinton, so not so long after she left Secretary of State, to her campaign manager, John Podesta. That email, it states that ISIS is funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, the governments of Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Now, I think this is the most significant email in the whole collection. And perhaps because Saudi and Qatari money is spread all over the place, including into many media institutions. All serious analysts know, even the US government has mentioned or agreed with, that some Saudi figures have been supporting ISIS, funding ISIS. But the dodge has always been it's just some rogue princes using their cut of the oil money to do whatever they like, but actually the government disapproves. But that email says that no, it is the governments of Saudi and the government and Qatar that have been funding ISIS.
The Saudis, the Qataris, the Moroccans, the Bahrainis, particularly the Saudis and the Qataris, are giving all this money to the Clinton Foundation, while Hillary Clinton is Secretary of State and the State Department is approving massive arms sales, particularly to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Under Hillary Clinton, and our Clinton emails reveal a significant discussion about it, the largest ever arms deal in the world was made with Saudi Arabia, more than $80 billion. In fact, during her tenure as Secretary of State, total arms exports from the United States, in terms of their dollar value, doubled.
Doubled. And of course, the consequence of that is that this notorious terrorist jihadist group called ISIL or ISIS is created largely with money from the very people who are giving money to the Clinton Foundation.
Yes.
All right. So that is definitely a hot topic right now with this Russia attack and the Islamic State claiming responsibility. I will say from my own experience, when I was in doing military intelligence stuff, they do sometimes claim stuff that is not directly theirs, but that they kind of retcon to be theirs. But before we get into that whole can of worms, I just wanted to reiterate that the U.S. wants to extradite Assange for this type of activism that he was doing, being outspoken against U.S. foreign policy, using leaked documents, for publishing these documents, and they want to sentence him for 100 to 175 years in prison. 17 accounts under the Espionage Act by claiming he is a spy/hacker, and one account of conspiracy to commit computer intrusion. So that's kind of where the case stands. It's been complex. It's been going on for a decade. I know you said you've been following it since you were in your 20s.
Yeah, early 20s. I've been following this case since I was in my early 20s. Well, I mean, the situation was that obviously the case itself only began following his arrest in 2019 from the Ecuadorian embassy when they officially tried to start the legal case against him. Prior to that, though, we know that they were constantly surveillancing him. There have been other means and attempts to try to shut down WikiLeaks, whether it's through the sexual harassment or rape allegations, which were then dropped from Sweden. So they've always tried to find ways and little loopholes legalistically speaking, in order to actually shut Julian Assange down. And it wasn't actually until 2019 where they managed it. And I think the reason for that, I think it was like sort of the cherry on the cake, was the revelations of the Vault 7 leaks, which were considered to be the largest leaks in CIA history, where there is pretty much what Snowden delivered, but like 10 times more, in the context of it was just basically a complete disclosure as to how the tech industry, the tech companies are essentially consistently surveillancing and spying, but also using hacking and computer viruses to basically infest people's electronic devices to essentially control information and spy and surveillance on people consistently. I mean, it's just putting it very mildly. I'm not a tech person. I won't be able to give you the exact details as maybe somebody who's more familiar with it. But because it was considered to be the greatest leak in CIA history, and it completely humiliated the CIA, because on top of that, it actually also disclosed the documents that he had leaked, also disclosed at the time how essentially their whole system works, how the CIA goes about surveillance. It's not just the methods that they use, but actually the whole programming process. So from that point on, I mean, he was definitely, he was a wanted man. So they managed
explain it to the audience a little bit. Basically, the Vault 7 stuff scandal was, you know, the agency, the Information Operations Center of the Central Intelligence Agency, had the software capabilities such as the ability to compromise cars, smart TVs, web browsers, including Google Chrome, Edge, Firefox, Opera. They could get into your all the operating systems in your cell phones. Apple iOS was compromised. The entire Android platform was compromised. Windows, Mac OS and Linux. And the Vault 7 release led to the CIA to actually redefine WikiLeaks as a, quote, non-state hostile intelligence service. So they prosecuted, they went after it pretty hard. Because as you said, it was really embarrassing. Yeah.
It was very embarrassing. But the thing is, like, the current case has nothing to actually even do with that. That's how you can tell, obviously, it's a direct attack on Julian Assange, because what they've managed to essentially do is go after him based on the Afghan diaries and the Iraqi leaks, which were obviously in conjunction with Chelsea Manning. That's what the case is based on. And there's the thing is, before we get into everything that was revealed and why also it matters, because this is the thing, people need to understand what's happening in Palestine, what's happening globally right now is also connected with Julian Assange. And it's of utmost importance that he is basically not extradited to the US and what it means in the general scheme of things. But essentially with what happened, well, the arguments that they're making are, with regards to this particular case, are inherently problematic, not just because he's being trialed as a foreign national under the American legal system. He isn't going to even be afforded any First Amendment rights, which is essentially, because he's not an American, he's not afforded First Amendment rights, but yet he's being trialed as an American, which itself doesn't even make sense. But one of the most interesting aspects of this case as well is not only did he collaborate with The Guardian, Der Spiegel, and other news outlets at the time in order to publicize the information with regards to the Iraqi diaries and the Afghan revelations, but actually he wasn't even the one to initially disclose or actually publicize the non-redacted documents, which basically provided the names of the informants and the people who had committed the crimes, right? Because this is what they're latching onto. The idea is that his revelations, what they're trying to target him with, is that he exposed American informants or informants in general, or individuals who had committed the crimes, essentially, to a dangerous situation. And as a result, he should be trialed under the Espionage Act. But this is the thing. Not only was it not him that had done so, it was actually The Guardian. So The Guardian, two reporters from The Guardian who had published a book at the time documenting Assange's life, were the ones that in their book, which they had actually written this book behind Julian Assange's back, essentially, because Assange didn't want to participate in a book about his life. So they did this without actually running it by him. What was interesting about it is that they had actually put in their book the password that Julian Assange gave them to the leaked documents. And when they gave them, when they publicized the password, within a matter of months, when obviously the book started circulating, I think it was published in, I think it was in February 2011. By September 2011, obviously, once the password was provided, anybody who understood how this software works was able to then sort of get into the documents and then publicize them. So actually, the information, these documents weren't even published by Assange, that with the names of the informants. It was actually published by a U.S. Based company called Cryptome, I think, and the owner or the co-founder called John Young had also stated as such. And that was actually the first online platform that provides sort of leaked documents, had published these documents without the redacted names. that then Julian Assange tried to salvage by then also publicizing them. But the problem actually started from The Guardian publishing the password that allowed anybody essentially to be able to get into the leaked documents and publicize them. Yet The Guardian is not being prosecuted, but Julian Assange is being prosecuted. And interestingly, the person, John Young, who owns Cryptome, he's not being prosecuted either. And he actually showed up in court and said, I was the one that initially published these documents, yet I'm not the one that's being trialed, nor is anybody else. So this just goes to show that this is a direct attack on Julian Assange more than it is anything else. And another, go on.
But real quick, we should circle back to the actual breach in operational security coming from Chelsea Manning. Just to reiterate for everybody, here's a page from Open Society Justice Initiative entitled Disproportionate Sentence for Leak of Government Files. So Chelsea, formerly Bradley Manning, while serving in the U.S. Army, found documents which suggested that there have been more than 15,000 unreported civilian deaths in Afghanistan and Iraq, and that the U.S. military had failed to investigate detainee abuse and torture. Manning released thousands of pages of documents to WikiLeaks, and Manning was charged with espionage offenses, and conviction was sentenced to 35 years in prison. In January 2017, Obama commuted her sentence, acknowledging that it was disproportionate compared with others convicted of leaking documents. And so that's an interesting point to bring up in light of the fact that they're trying to sentence Assange to 175 years.
Yeah, and there's also a bit of an irrationality there. I mean, it was disproportionate. I mean, that's actually one of the arguments that the United States was trying to make in the court, that it was disproportionate, therefore it constitutes as a crime. I mean, it doesn't even make any sense. It doesn't even make any sense that they published that the level of information that was leaked was so intense that therefore, it's just completely irrational.
Yeah, but I do remember, because I was in the military when a lot of these documents were leaked. I mean, I had a security clearance at the time, and I knew like some shady stuff was happening. But how classification works is like there's really not much higher than a top secret security clearance, but everything's compartmentalized. So you're like, you'll only have like code word clearances for something, and it only like each code word clearance really only aligns with a certain narrow band of operations that you're involved with. So it's like really hard to get a scope of like everything that's going on, especially if you're like boots on the ground guy like I was, because like the whole like capture thing was possible. So fewer code word clearances than an analyst. But I remember one video that was really shocking to see, and I'm going to pull that up. It's from the Iraq War. It's basically an Apache helicopter lighting up a bunch of clearly unarmed civilian men. The pilot's asking for permission to engage again and again, and it's completely inexcusable, and it's quite clearly a war crime. So pulling that up now. And this was again, the big one.
On the internet today by WikiLeaks, a whistleblower website. And it shows graphic gun camera images of a U.S. helicopter attack in Baghdad in July 2007.
And the weapon, yeah.
The aerial assault plays out over 40 minutes with an Apache helicopter pilot, call sign Crazy Horse 18, repeatedly requesting permission to fire on a group of men he believes to be insurgents.
Hotel 26, is Crazy Horse 18. Have individuals with weapons.
Report radio.
You're clear.
All right, firing.
The Apache and a second gunship open up with machine guns as the men on the ground try to flee. A short time later, they ask again for permission to fire.
Come on, let us shoot. Come on.
Clear.
More than a dozen people were killed. It's believed that two Iraqis working for the Reuters news service were among the dead. For 2 years, the Pentagon has refused to release the video or the findings of its internal investigation. But WikiLeaks says it obtained the video from whistleblowers and then published it to prove that the helicopters were not under fire or acting in self-defense.
Yep, and the documents that were released said that was something that happened not infrequently.
Not exactly, and that's the thing. That's actually part of, that's only a small clip. The actual video, the video that was released was like around 14 minutes long, and there were even more crimes that were documented, but this was one of the ones that were actually most popular and were actually shown to the world to see. And the thing is, yeah, according to the documents, I mean, it was, they were basically consistently targeting unarmed civilians. There was a lot of information coming out of Afghanistan at the time that by checkpoints, soldiers, American soldiers were essentially, I think there was something called the Black Unit. I can't remember, this is a certain name that was given to, but there was a nickname Black Unit that was essentially whenever they felt that they, the checkpoints were under some sort of threat or somebody approached too close, they would basically shoot. They've shot women, they shot children, they shot pregnant women. They've shot men that would go to, were trying to pass the checkpoint with their pregnant wife that was about to give labor. So there was a lot, there were a lot of civilian casualties in the thousands that were essentially like either severely wounded or killed by the military at the time. And this is what the documents had actually revealed. And interestingly, given what's happening as well right now in Palestine, it's pretty much the same sort of practices where there is an abuse of the military is abusing their power in a sense on a civilian population. And the United States was very aware of it, but they weren't taking the necessary steps to actually monitor these soldiers. And it didn't even just stop there, but also, for example, some of the militias or whether it be Iraqi militias or Afghani militias that were sort of working alongside the United States at the time were also conducting torture and extrajudicial killings. And again, the United States was aware of it, as we've seen through the link through these leaks, and did absolutely nothing about it.
I mean, that is something that I know for a fact happened, especially the extrajudicial killings of partnership units like in Iraq, or, you know, the Afghan partnership units in Afghanistan that were composed of Afghans doing a lot of the dirty work as well.
And that's the thing, because from the leaks, what it basically said is that a lot of the soldiers at the time, and bearing in mind, by the way, another thing that was also revealed within the leaks is that it also exposed the degree of private companies. And obviously, so not just the U.S. military, but the fact that the United States military was obviously hiring private corporations and private companies essentially to work as a military unit within the Iraq war. And these particular units were less inclined to actually abide by the law. But again, the United States was not sort of monitoring them as well as they should have, essentially, or they didn't care to. They sort of willingly turned a blind eye to the kind of crimes that they were committing. But the fact of the matter is that they were conducting, you know, things like night raids and targeting civilians. And one of the policies that they had at the time is that they would essentially target, say, Afghani men or Iraqi men and kill them, even if they weren't sure, essentially, if they were part of, let's just say, the Taliban or any sort of other considered Islamic group or militant. So there was a policy of essentially shoot to kill an alleged militant, which is not following legal due process. You're not supposed to do something like that. And there was information that came out of these leaks that essentially said that on occasions, and this actually happened again, even outside of these leaks anyway, with the British military and like the special elite forces, but this is another conversation, where they were even planting essentially AK-47s on occasions next to the bodies of these men in order to say, well, you know, to imply that they were actually a danger. What a lot of the leaks proved that this wasn't actually the case.
Yeah. The technical term for that is a drop gun. So some people did carry drop guns. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, like the reason as well why this is so important is because we're seeing exactly the same things happen, not just in Gaza, but also in the West Bank. I mean, we're seeing Palestinian resistance, essentially, or young men being targeted, like, for example, in the hospital in the West Bank where they killed a boy who was actually sleeping with his friends. I think he was paralyzed with the undercover doctors. I remember the advanced Israeli military unit dressing up as undercover doctors or lay persons, and then they're walking around, and then they went in and executed him. And under the guise, oh, well, there were militants, but they weren't a threat. So it goes back to that. I mean, we can't expect the United States of America or the UK for that matter, because the UK is also complicit in even in the leaks that we've seen from Julian Assange. We can't expect them to hold a certain standard. We can't expect them to hold Israel to a certain standard where they've engaged in a similar sort of crimes and very willingly. And the state didn't do anything to actually hold these soldiers and the private companies that were working with the United States military at the time. They have done nothing to actually hold these people accountable.
No, and we do send soldiers to jail and pilots to jail, but it's not a universal thing. One salient difference, like that I've seen, is like they don't send anybody. There's no prosecutions within the IDF. The U.S. Court of Military Justice is selective, but at least something exists. I'm not seeing any evidence that this exists within the IDF, but.
But you're saying, okay, I mean, the United States, but of course, I mean, I think the argument that I'm trying to make here is more so along the lines of there's a certain practice that we've seen and that's what essentially was revealed through the leaks, mm-hmm. and how the United States can willingly decide or choose to turn a blind eye,
yeah.
that essentially creates, which brings to question the moral integrity of the United States and how well it's able to actually hold Israel accountable as well. I mean, we know that Israel isn't going to hold itself accountable, but I mean, look at the crimes that they're committing for the world to see, right? I mean, a lot of their crimes have been very well documented. And I think this is also one of the significance as well of the leaks from Julian Assange. At that time, say in 2007, for example, the helicopter shootings with the Apache helicopters happened in 2007. We didn't have the sort of the camera, the social media platforms that Palestinians have today in order to reveal these crimes. So what Julian Assange did is provide the evidence that we couldn't possibly have access to at the time, but yet he provided that evidence. And what it proves is that there is a systematic problem within the ranks of the military, whether it's Israel, the United States, of essentially killing unarmed civilians. And it sort of turns into a bit of a game as well. I mean, I was watching Julian Assange give an interview with John Pilger from 2011. He said, if you watch the whole video of the Apache helicopter shootings, the soldiers were sort of speaking about it like it was a game. And there was, discussions of body counts and things like that. It's sort of like the same fundamental ethical problem. I mean, another thing that was revealed in the Afghan diaries was how they were dropping 2,000-pound bombs on targets that were supposed to be allegedly Taliban fighters, resulting to the deaths of hundreds of civilians. So they'll be dropping 200-pound bombs in a location that said, okay, well, this is where Taliban fighters are supposed to be. It wasn't even guaranteed these were Taliban fighters. But then again, it's sort of the same thing that we're seeing in Israel, where they, I think, bombed the Jabalia camp. Refugee camp, saying, oh, there was one Hamas fighter, and then pretty much killed God knows how many civilians and injured many more. So we're seeing the same sort of similar tactics, and that's essentially what Julian Assange had revealed with Chelsea Manning through the leaks, the Afghan leaks.
So there are different targeting protocols based off I'll just say that there's a difference between military targeting and three-letter agency targeting. One is a civilian organization that has a complete different set of rules. So,
I think what's also important to note here as well is that. Because I think it's also important to understand the nuances of this case in the sense of. When I initially brought up the fact that it wasn't even Julian Assange that had actually disclosed the names of the informants or the names of the people who had in any way participated in these crimes, it's important to note that because the United States is arguing that he exposed these people to danger, right? And that's why they're actually trying him under the Espionage Act. But the Espionage Act, it was actually made for the purpose of protecting the United States and not disclosing information at a time of war. And if that information, if you receive that information, you shouldn't disclose it if you have the intention to bring about harm to the United States. Now, one of the important aspects of this is that, first of all, there was no such intention behind Julian Assange. He received the information, and when he published that information, it was not a threat to the United States. But also what it actually had done was help basically bring about the end of the war of terror or the war on terror, because when these crimes became known, it coerced the United States to stop or to basically crack down on this behavior, bringing an end to sort of abuses that we were seeing that were actually then presented. And this is very important because the argument here is that he exposes people to dangers. And the other aspect that we have to remind ourselves of here is that Chelsea Manning, when she was court-martialed, there was an entire investigation, and it was found that none of the names that were even published anyway, that none of them were actually hurt in any specific way. So not only did it not pose any threat to the United States itself, but it didn't actually bring any harm to the individuals that were disclosed in these documents. And what it actually did do is that it saved civilians, Iraqis and Afghanis from actually facing similar circumstances as others in the 10 years of the war on terror. So I think it's very important to also understand this and why Julian Assange's leaks were so fundamental.
No, I can speak directly to that. The entire targeting parameters changed after this quite rapidly. So when I was in Afghanistan, if you were going to perform a kinetic strike, it actually couldn't target infrastructure in any way. So if someone was walking on a road, couldn't do it, even if it was like a confirmed hit of whatever target individual you're going after. So they became very, very strict. I'm not saying a bunch of shady stuff didn't happen, but it certainly wasn't as visible or as widespread. We actually adopted something called General McChrystal championed in Afghanistan. It was called COIN, Counterinsurgency Dynamics and Doctrine. So it kind of changed pretty much everything on a global scale.
Yeah, because now there was a certain degree of due diligence because there was a fear factor placed in about any sort of disclosures like this happening again. And so this coerced the United States military to take much more care, which they should have done in the very beginning, to make sure that they're following and abiding by international law and making sure that they're not providing any risk to the civilian population, which is not what was happening up until that point. The other aspect about this as well that we have to bear in mind when we're looking at the court case itself, because it talks about so he has 17 charges of espionage, but then there's also an account of conspiring conspiring against the, let me just double check it, conspiring against the state, basically. And there's another issue with this, essentially, because this creates a fundamental problem because one of the arguments that the United States is saying is that Chelsea Manning was not essentially able, she would not have hacked into the computers had it not been for Julian Assange, that Julian Assange basically helped her do so, right? So rather than Chelsea Manning getting access to this information and just simply providing it to Julian Assange, and he just basically published it as a journalist, they're saying that Julian Assange essentially guided her into hacking into the government computers and basically retrieving this information. And so this creates a problem as well, where they're conflating a journalist as a whistleblower. They're treating him as a whistleblower. And this is going to, if they manage to extradite him to the United States, this would basically bring to question any future, any journalist in the future who will have access to, say, key information could then also be treated as a whistleblower and be trialed accordingly, rather than Julian Assange simply received the information. And this therefore has serious implications because you're setting now a very dangerous precedent.
Right. Also, the thing is, he did make a lot of waves, not just because of the information he revealed. He started going on publicly talking about how Afghanistan was one basic massive money laundering scheme, yes, made to take tax dollars, put it into a eternal war or forever war in Central Asia, wash it through, you know, security contractors and, you know, give it back to the security elite, essentially. And I actually, when he started talking about that and, you know, I saw the COIN Dynamics PowerPoint slide that I'm going to bring up, it didn't look like a war that was ever meant to be won. So, let me just show you guys this slide of COIN Dynamics real quick. Sorry if you're listening. I'll tell you how to research it or look it up. It is right here.
And there's also an importance. There's an importance about that as well because of what's happening in Ukraine. But yeah, we'll get into it.
Yeah. Okay. So this is what was put out around the same time he was talking about Afghanistan being a massive money laundering scheme. So this is called, as I brought up, Afghan Stability COIN Dynamics Security Slide. So we jokingly jokingly call this slide the PowerPoint slide that lost the war. So this is only a small part of it. It's this massive thing that fits on a wall that you have to look at and examine through an overhead projector. But it's hard to explain. It's just a squiggly spaghetti mush pile of incomprehensible quote-unquote dynamics from government capacity, population and beliefs, ANSF institutional. When I saw this, we all had the impression, it was like, okay, this is what the battle space looks like. What do we even do with this? So even as a kid, you know, in my early 20s, like doing basic like intel, like human analysis and collection and stuff, I was just like, okay, how do we even unpack any of this? And it's my personal belief that Afghanistan ended when the imperialist cycle had completed itself.
Exactly. I mean, that's basically also what the leaks had actually disclosed at the time, that there was something like millions, I think like 300 million that was basically being funneled through the United States. I mean, a lot of these corporations, private corporations and the military industrial complex was basically using Afghanistan to flush money through and then bring it back into the United States. That's basically what it was. So like 300 million was going into the United States, was going into Afghanistan, but supposedly the government was only receiving about 30 million. So where the hell the rest of the money went? And that's what some of these documents had actually disclosed at the time. And I think this is also very important because, yeah, he made his famous statement. It's not about war. It's not about winning a war. It's about endless war, because the industrial military complex makes its money, obviously, through the selling and of weaponry, but also through the hiring of these, you know, private companies to fight within these territories, but also through using it essentially like a form of tax haven and laundering money through these territories. And we're seeing the same thing occur anyway now in Ukraine. I think, I mean, there's millions flowing into Ukraine. I think something like 178 billion, not even million, billion has been given to Ukraine as a whole. And I think even the United States Congress have refused to essentially pass a bill that will audit that money, which essentially means that money's flowing into Ukraine, but it's not being audited. There's no way to actually make sure that the money's going where it's supposed to go. And that really brings to question how, you know, how this money's essentially being used.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lack of auditing and accountability is very common within the defense industrial complex, you know, so it's nothing new. But I think what coming back to Julian Assange, he was the one who, in conjunction with facilitating these leaked informations and talking about it publicly and gaining a following, I think that put a target on his back for sure. And all of this trial, everything smacks of revenge attempt, make an example attempt.
Yeah, it's the point. It's make an example out of him, criminalize journalism. It's essentially what's going to happen, where any journalist at this point who will at any particular point maybe even receive information that is going to be considered to be dire to the state or to the establishment could be trialed as essentially under the Espionage Act and imprisoned. And I think something that's also important about this case and what needs to be understood is that he's been extradited to the United States under a treaty that was signed in 2003 between the UK and the United States. And this is called the extradition treaty. And essentially, it's actually considered to be illegal to extradite a political prisoner. It's not actually something that's permitted. But yet, Julian Assange is extradited within the context of as being a political prisoner.
Yeah, so it just kind of seems like they want the veneer of a legal framework, but all of these interpretations of that framework seem absolutely bizarre. So coming back to just taking out the last chunk of time of this court case, let's start in like 2021. The first time the extradition order, they tried to extradite him to the United States, a British judge at the district court blocked his extradition because of the danger that U.S. prison conditions would have on his volatile mental health. Like the U.S. prisons are so bad, he'd essentially commit suicide. And the fact that given his current mental health, yeah, due to years of psychological torture because of this case, an extradition would lead to that. So that's the first time it was blocked.
Yes. And the thing is well, I think, so his mental health has been poorly, because the fact of the matter is, it's not, Belmarsh prison is the high, is considered to be like high maximum security prison. He's basically held in solitary confinement 23 hours of the day. It's just a form of psychological torture. And as I think you said in your intro, I mean, multiple United Nations, investigations have classified this as arbitrary detention, which is illegal under international law, under customary international law, but it's also a form of century of torture. And the fact of the matter is, even before he was held in Belmarsh prison, and where he's obviously held under very brutal conditions, Julian Assange, even when he was in the Ecuadorian embassy, I mean, he was pretty much confined in a very small room, and he already began taking a toll on his mental health. So he had been held in the Ecuadorian embassy since 2011 until pretty much 2009. So he has essentially been held in some sort of arbitrary detention for pretty much the last 15 years. It's not something that's new. And as a result, his health has deteriorated so significantly. But this is the thing as well. One of the reasons as well, in the 2021 ruling there was an agreement that his health wouldn't be able to sustain going to the United States, and that the United States needs to provide sort of certain securities, which we're seeing sort of the same outcome now. But the other aspect is that the United States, right, who has deemed that they're going to take care of him, they're not going to bring any harm to his health, is also a country that planned his assassination by the CIA. The CIA, we have documents published by Yahoo article, verifiable documents that prove that the CIA was planning to assassinate and kill him. So essentially, that really brings the question, how are we going to extradite this man to the United States, to a hostile state that essentially was planning on killing him, and then expecting the United States to abide by treating him humanely and making sure that no harm was going to come his way?
And wasn't Mike Pompeo the director of the Central Intelligence Agency when that happened?
Yeah, it was. Under the Trump administration, Mike Pompeo was the...
Mike Pompeo's a team bomb Iran, by the way, just so everyone's tracking. He definitely doesn't want anything to be scrutinized that the U.S. does in terms of existential foreign policy. So since then, they're trying to get him back. Assange's team appealed the decision in 2021. Let's see. Yeah, it just seems like a lot of back and forth over the past few years, and it's only gaining now a lot of attention because I feel like maybe you'll disagree with this because of within the context of Palestine, this is becoming more and more important. Or people are just more aware politically.
I think people are more aware. I think the last 4 to 5 years, I mean, everything from, okay, when COVID began, and then afterwards we had the war in Ukraine, and we've seen the impacts of the war in Ukraine, and now everything's going on in Gaza. There's been an accumulation of events that have happened that are triggering a global sense of conscious awareness as to what is happening. And the fact that there are things that are somewhat fundamentally wrong with the way that the government establishments are functioning. And as a result, Julian Assange's case is becoming a little bit more prominent and more aware. People are beginning to realize, well, okay, especially with Palestine, yes, look at the crimes that, it's what we said, look at the crimes that Israel is committing. Julian Assange revealed the same level of crime, let's say, to a certain extent with the United States. And now he's basically being put into a situation where he's going to be extradited and put in jail for 175 years. But he also runs the risk of actually put on the death penalty. And there's an infamous video with Trump saying, oh, you know, he probably should be put on the death penalty. Hillary Clinton said the same thing. And this is another aspect of this, by the way. The United States can make all the assurances it wants in the world and say, well, you know what? We're not going to touch Julian Assange. He's going to be safe in our hands. But the fact of the matter is, the United States has a history as well of actually violating the terms of the extradition, and actually could very well put him on the death penalty. And from that point on, there's not really anything you can do. And just a small little parenthesis here, it's actually under the British legal system, it's illegal under British law to extradite someone that you know may receive the death penalty. And having said that, even if he doesn't receive the death penalty, placing him in jail for 175 years is pretty much a death sentence anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that's beyond life. And I don't think there's any channels to get to shave like 150 years off that, even if he had 25 years left. I hope my math's right. I'm horrible at math, but yeah.
No, but it's what it is. And so at this point, he's been extradited as a political prisoner, which is illegal under the treaty between the United States and the UK. So it doesn't even make any legal sense. He wasn't even the person to actually publish the information with the names of the informants or with the people who had actually committed the crimes. Interestingly, none of the people that had committed the crimes had actually been punished, but Julian Assange is. The other journalists that were participating in, who had also published these documents, and including the two journalists that had published the Guardian book, are also not being prosecuted. And ultimately, it just seems more and more that there's no legality base in any of this, and that this is just a direct attack on Assange, meant to intimidate and terrorize every journalist. That if you publish or even get your hands on information that is considered top secret or it will anyway compromise the establishment, you will face essentially death.
Yeah, and you know he did piss off a lot of career politicians and political dynasties that still exist today. Hillary Clinton disappeared for 4 years, 5 years, 6 years after she lost to Trump. Well, she's back now. She's jet setting all over the world at the moment. And I think she definitely is a policy mover still.
I mean, she is. Look, with the video that you opened up, I think it's also very important. I mean, he basically, the leaks that he had, he was also involved, obviously, in the leaks of 2016, which was the Hillary Clinton leaks, the email leaks that he had put out. And at that time, nobody actually put any emphasis on what was said in the leaks, because everybody was more concerned with the fact that, oh, it was Russian intervention, even though Julian Assange has come on record and said it has absolutely nothing to do with Russia. Russia was not the one that actually was not the source of these leaks. And furthermore, anyway, we know at this point there's been multiple intelligence analytics that have disproved certain, well, they've never been able to verify it anyway. But the fact of the matter is, the leaks actually prove, just for example, how Hillary Clinton, but not just Hillary Clinton, the entire establishment in the United States is connected, as we saw in the video, with ISIS, the creation of ISIS. And we know what ISIS came to mean in the Middle East, what it did to Syria, what it did in Libya. And so, It's insane that the United States establishment helped fund and facilitate the Islamic State, which is a criminal entity that brought about the deaths of so many people in the region. But Julian Assange was simply providing that information for the world to know, which therefore provides power to the people to be able to have more tangibility and as in access to that power by questioning that power and holding that power accountable, is the one essentially being sentenced. Whilst in the meantime, Hillary Clinton is going on press tours here and there and never held to question about her involvement essentially and her connections with ISIS or those who fund ISIS.
Yeah, well, how they framed it back in the day was like, oops, like we funded the Al-Nusra Front, which were some militia groups definitely affiliated with Al-Qaeda that were going to, for us, fight a proxy battle against the Assad and the Russian-backed and Iranian-backed Assad regime in Syria. And whoops, Frankenstein monster appears, and now we have to fight the Islamic State that grew out of that. So that's the overriding narrative at the moment.
Yeah, no, and this is the thing. When we're talking about ISIS as well, I think it's important to understand. I mean, look, the origins of ISIS we know is connected to Al-Qaeda. There was sort of a branch of Al-Qaeda that was in itself, even as Hillary Clinton herself had sort of openly stated, funded by the United States in the 80s in order to combat the Soviet influence of Afghanistan at the time. And from 2003, 2004 onwards, there were these sort of factions within Iraq that were affiliated with Al-Qaeda, but they didn't rise to any sort of prominence at the time. It wasn't until 2012, 2013 that we started to see the formation of ISIS, and that came along with the CIA operations or investment to groups or opposition groups to overthrow Assad. And I think this was called Operation Timber Sycamore, I think that was the official name given by the CIA, Operation Timber Sycamore, where over $1 trillion was invested into these militias, into these organizations, and essentially creating what was a little sub-branch or a group of people's little militias working alongside Al-Qaeda into an entire military structure. And interestingly, actually, Operation Timber Sycamore, Obama, the Obama administration at the time, wasn't in favor of funding these organizations or these militias, let's just say. And it was actually the King of Jordan and Benjamin Netanyahu who lobbied very strongly at that time to coerce the United States government to, well, not coerce, but to Obama at the time to essentially fund these organizations. And we now know, based on, you know, leaked intelligence documents, they weren't actually leaked, but intelligence documents that have been publicized since on 12th of August, 2012, for example, that the United States were very well aware that the groups that they were essentially funding were those al-Nusra, they were all basically Islamic extremist groups. And these they were basically working along Al-Qaeda. And in fact, there was an email between Hillary Clinton and Jake Sullivan at the time, again in 2012, telling Hillary Clinton Al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. So they're very well aware that Al-Qaeda, ISIS, again, it's the same monster, different names given to the same monster, the same branch. And they were very well aware of it. And yet they were funding them. And this was also reaffirmed by former intelligence advisor Michael Flynn in 2015 with an interview he had with, I think, Mehdi Hassan on Al Jazeera, where he said, yeah, the United States government, State Department, were very well aware that these groups, al-Nusra or all these opposition groups, were essentially affiliated with Al-Qaeda, and they continued funding them. And then with what Julian Assange had actually revealed in the in the Hillary Clinton emails was essentially that the Saudi Arabia and Qatar, yes, they were also funding these groups. But if you go back to the Operation Timber Sycamore, the CIA also was working alongside very closely with Saudi Arabia at the time, the Saudi Arabian intelligence. So when they were funding these groups, it was alongside Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, we know for a fact, and it's confirmed through the Hillary Clinton emails that they were aware that Saudi Arabia was funding as well the same group, what is known today as ISIS. And Hillary Clinton had very close relationships with Saudi Arabia. And obviously, as the video said, when she was Undersecretary of State at the time, you know, she was receiving lucrative deals in the Clinton Foundation from Saudi officials. And she made huge arms agreements, the biggest arms agreement with Saudi Arabia. So, I mean, you can see how it all works, essentially. I mean, Saudi Arabia, the United States, Qatar, they were all as a collective creating this organization known as ISIS in the region, which is an extremist group that brought about the deaths of so many civilians and so much, the barbarity of ISIS actions were, you know, we've all seen it, we've all documented it. And Hillary Clinton was very much the head of all this. And when Julian Assange disclosed these emails, and this was such a groundbreaking piece of information, at the time, rather than focus on what was being revealed, the conversation was about Russia in order to distract the public from the truth.
Yeah. And also, since 9/11, we've turned the word terrorist into a thought-terminating cliche. It's like, oh, they're terrorists. Done. Critical thought. Over. So, I mean, we're seeing that now. There's no differentiation. I mean, ISIS is still useful. You know, you just conflate Hamas with ISIS and people are like, oh, they must be part of the same group, even though actually ISIS would most likely target Hamas before they target the IDF because Hamas are apostates, you know, and it's a whole crazy thing.
But exactly, that's why I said before in Operation Timber Sycamore, that was advocated for strongly by Benjamin Netanyahu, and that entire operation was funding the creation of ISIS. So Benjamin Netanyahu was very strongly behind that. And I've always argued, I mean, isn't it interesting how ISIS has never targeted Israel ever? I mean, even now, apparently ISIS claimed that they're the ones that are behind the Tehran attacks that killed 115 people. And now they're claiming that they're behind the attacks in Russia. Which have killed, I don't know, at this point, I've lost the number. I think it was 170 people, but I think the number has increased. I mean, it's still ongoing, so I'm not quite sure what the number is at the moment. But, I mean, ISIS is claiming, and interestingly, both Iran and Russia at this particular point in time have done more to, let's just say, try to aid the Palestinian side of the argument and have been more, obviously, they've condemned Israel, and yet ISIS, who claims to be this Islamic group, have gone after particularly Iran and Russia in the space of a month and a half.
Yeah, interestingly, one of the Taliban, the Taliban caliphates or whatever they're calling themselves right now, the Taliban's biggest existential and internal threat is ISIS-K, Islamic State in the Khorasan, which is the Khorasan is the ancient Persian lands. So it's funny how that all works out. But anyways, since we're getting short on time, this all comes back, this huge scandal to Julian Assange. Like, he was the central, it's more about him, I feel like, more about him being a central figure than him being, you know, actually a prosecutable whistleblower that broke operational security in contravention of a top secret security clearance non-disclosure agreement.
And that's the problem, because as we've said, it's what will this do in terms of free press, freedom of expression, how will this essentially hold journalists essentially accountable for doing their job? And when you're in a situation where, as a journalist, you're going to be too afraid to publicize information that the public ought to know, and you're going to obviously opt not to because you don't want to be punished, that means that information will no longer be available to the public, who has a right to know how their state is acting on their behalf, or how their money has been spent. For example, the taxpayers' money has been spent. Like, we have a right to information. Information is a very powerful tool that can be essentially used to question the elite that govern us. Because, you know, more often than not, we talk about democracy, right? And what democracy means. Well, democracy essentially is demokratia, which basically means people's governance in Greek, right? Demokratia. And the whole purpose, the traditional definition of democracy is to prevent the establishment of an oligarchy, which means the centralized control by a few. But that's essentially what we have in much of the Western world, and particularly in the United States. And they essentially control, as we can see now, the judicial system, the media. And when you have somebody as an independent, which is Julian Assange, who is essentially challenging the establishment by providing the information that will illuminate the truth, therefore bring about true democracy, because people will start to question and challenge their authority, which is the whole purpose of democracy, they want to shut it down. And they are criminalizing him in order to sort of basically make an example out of him.
Yeah. And, bringing up the classical Greek kind of definition of democracy, or just saying it in the modern Greek, reminded me of Aristotle's Cycles of Democracy, how he distinguished five forms of government, starting with aristocracy and ending with tyranny, and the cycle repeats itself. So, like, aristocracy to timocracy to oligarchy to democracy to tyranny. And that's what people are worried about with, like, Trump. And then revolution burns itself down, cycle starts over again. But apparently freedom of the press is supposed to protect us from that, to expose wannabe tyrants and wannabe systems of monopolized power in both the public and private sectors.
Exactly. I mean, to be quite honest with you, like I've always said, there's really no distinguishing between the public and the private sector. It's just basic law one.
Yeah,
I did mention that. You know, sometimes we make this distinction, it really gives the illusion that there's some sort of a choice, like there, you know, that there is a distinct, like because if we say that the public and private sector, then we're implying that the public sector actually holds the private sector accountable, but it doesn't, because it's basically one and the same. As we saw with Hillary Clinton, for example, who is a political entity who's supposed to be impartial and to look out of the interests of the state, but yet she's got her foundation, is receiving money from the Saudis, and then she's making deals accordingly, et cetera. So, you know, it's complicated. But what I was going to also say, I think, with the decision that came out today, because we didn't discuss the decision, I think it's important to discuss. So at this point, the decision has been that the United States has 3 weeks to essentially provide assurances that that Julian Assange will be treated as a national, meaning that he's going to have access to the First Amendment rights, which initially wasn't the case, that he will not get the death penalty, and that essentially he will be treated well. Let's just say it like that, which is sort of the same, the premise of the same thing. Yeah. They've got 3 weeks to provide evidence for that, by which then, if they fail to do so, then, well, Assange will have a right to appeal. But even if they do provide the assurances, it's going to be another trial, I think on the 20th of May, if I remember correctly. And on the 20th of May, there's going to be a decision based on those assurances given. Within that context, Julian Assange could again appeal, but this time it will be to the European Court of Human Rights, which is going to be Strasbourg. And if that happens, at that point, we won't just be looking at the extradition to the United States. We're also going to be trialing the British legal system, because it essentially, any extradition to the United States of a political prisoner, because at this point, it's again, like I said, it's arbitrary detention. It's a violation of law. I mean, he hasn't, there's no reason for him to even be in jail right now. There's absolutely no reason for him to be in jail right now. But, you know, I think the European Court of Human Rights it's going to be less likely, I believe, based on the legal structure of the European Union and the articles. I mean, if you look at even the Human Rights Act of 1998 here, which is based on the European human rights piece of legislation, they violated, I mean, even the UK at this point has violated every law imaginable. So the entire British system will be held accountable if this was to go through to the European Court of Human Rights. But that's the situation that we're in at the moment, which I think is, you know, important to clarify. But yeah, it's fundamental to all of us that Julian Assange is not extradited. It's fundamental to all of us that he's basically let free, because otherwise we're looking, if he is taken to the United States and placed in jail for basically informing the public of the truth, well, this is basically a threat to the very values of any democratic society.
Yeah, I mean, that's been a common threat since October. At least people have been waking up to it since October. People have been speaking about this for a long time before that, but now everything seems more pressing. So,
yeah, it is.
So,
I also
go ahead. Okay.
No, I also wanted to say, the thing is with Julian Assange as well is that the case made against him is basically also been treated as essentially a terrorist, which is another point that I think is important to mention, because under the Extradition Act 2003, the only instances where a political prisoner can be extradited is if they've committed acts of terrorism. So essentially, not only is he being treated as a whistleblower, but we're kind of blurring the lines now between journalism and what, terrorism?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you challenge Empire, you can be labeled a terrorist. I mean, they can't say it explicitly, but it's kind of functionally and performatively acting, playing out that way.
But that's absolutely terrifying. So anybody who basically makes a statement or reveals or challenges authority is going to be classified as a terrorist. So that
we're seeing that conflation happen right now, just outside like pro-Palestine protests. You know, not even if you're championing Hamas, just if you're like ceasefire now, they're conflating that with terrorism. So I mean, it's happening in multiple sectors, in multiple social spheres and contexts.
Exactly. So this is why it's very important that the public are aware. This is why it's so important to spread information when it comes to Assange and to become aware of it, because the more these power structures try to censor and use this terminology to, whether it's journalists, whether it's protesters, the more we're basically giving, we're conceding our rights away, we're giving our rights away. And yeah, it's a very dangerous time because we're always, like I said, we're always looking at the, especially in the Western world, they're always constantly criticizing the democracies of other countries and other states. But in the meantime, I mean, look at the state of Western democracy. It's really far from that.
You could argue it's a shambles. Or a farce at this point.
It's a farce. Yeah, it's a farce. I mean, that's all it is. I mean, even something I actually thought of, you know, bringing up in this conversation. I mean, it's a, even when he was in the Ecuadorian embassy, I mean, and he was trying to seek refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy, kind of, I wanted to bring this up because it's an interesting little dynamic. It connects to the conversation that we previously had. When he was in the Ecuadorian embassy, the way by which the United States was actually able to get Assange to be essentially thrown out of the embassy because he was dragged out of the embassy, right? That's how they took, mm-hmm. that's how they initially had arrested him at the time. It was, you know, the United States had essentially given, again, through the use of the IMF, because Ecuador was obviously in a difficult financial situation. The IMF on the 11th of March basically gave Ecuador a $4.3 billion loan. And then by the 11th of April, the British police was basically dragging Assange out of the Ecuadorian embassy. So again, we're seeing how the United States and how the, again, the financial elite here, like the IMF is supposed to be a separate institution, but we know it's basically a branch of the United States, was using its power over another state to financially strain the economy of Ecuador so as to say, right, because the United States has to be the country that gave the AOK for any sort of loan. And then in doing so, they provided lucrative means in order to get Julian Assange to be basically thrown out of the Ecuadorian embassy and placed in jail. So this is how the establishment works. It's very, you know, it's, you got the state using the IMF, coercing another state into basically prosecuting a journalist.
Yep. So that's where we're at right now. Perhaps we can circle back on this in a month after a verdict has been rendered. So,
oh, yeah, on the 20th of May. I mean, they've got 3 weeks, and then we'll see what the outcome is going to be.
Yeah. All right, y'all. Well, thanks for listening. That's the intro version to all this very complicated issue involving Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, and the United States and UK governments and the West in general. So thanks, y'all, for listening, and hope this was helpful. Hope to see you next time. And thanks, Alina, for coming on. All right, bye-bye.